Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We're going to start with the non-Valencias. Our current forecast for December is 7 million boxes. That's down 36% from our October forecast of 11 million boxes.
Mark Hudson with the National Ag Statistics Service.
And when you compare that to previous year of the 7 million boxes, it's 62% down from last season and 69% from 2 years ago. For our Valencias, our October forecast was 17 million. Our December forecast is 13 million, also down 4 million boxes, which is a reduction of 24% from our October forecast. It's down 43% from the previous year. Our all orange forecast for December is 20 million boxes compared to October forecast of 28 million boxes. That's down 29% from October and down 51% from previous year.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There were no changes reported for the U.S. wheat balance sheet. However, USDA did reduce the average cash price down a dime.
Donna Hughes is a senior risk management consultant with StoneX.
Global production was reduced by 2 million metric tons. Global ending stocks were reported at 267.3 million metric tons, and this compares to the November estimate of 267.82 million metric tons.
She's breaking down the latest numbers from Friday's USDA World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, or WASD, report.
USDA lowered exports 75 million bushels, and this brought corn exports to 2.075 billion bushels, down 16% from last year at this time. South American numbers remained unchanged, with total world output cut by 6.5 million metric tons to 125.83 million metric tons.
And for soybeans?
USDA left the domestic balance sheet unchanged from November. Soy meal was also left unchanged, with soy oil data reflecting tighter carry-in stocks on reduced imports. Global soybean production was left mostly unchanged.
And the numbers that the industry just can't quite understand, cotton.
USDA raised the U.S. cotton yield to 186 pounds per acre. This was up 13 pounds per acre, the highest since 2018. U.S. production was raised to 14.24 million bales, up 210,000 bales. Carryout was reported at 3.5 million bales, up 500,000 from the November estimate and 250,000 tighter year over year.
Why are those numbers surprising? Kotick Besson is president and CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
From an overall production-based standpoint, you know, certainly this is no unknown to anyone throughout our area, the upper high plains through Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas. But it's been a difficult year. Mother Nature has certainly unwielded a little bit of unkindness this year, be it a lack of rainfall or even just the high vast temperatures we saw through the growing months. And so our production is going to be substantially lower than what we've seen historically, and certainly could be one of the more catastrophic years that we've seen since the early 1950s from a production-based standpoint. Now, you get outside of the Southwest region and over into the Mid-South or Southern Southeast, and they're set to really shape up and have a pretty decent crop. Overall, they do have some quality-based impact that they're seeing. But fortunately, they've been to escape some of the weather-related incidents, be it the recent hurricane that ran through the portion of Florida and up through the southeast coast. And so we'll see some decent protection throughout those regions as a whole. But it's unique. Every area is faced with certainly its difficulties and challenges. This year has just been kind of one for the records. Overall, from a ginning capacity standpoint, one favorable note is, at least up in some of the conversations we've had in the panhandle area with folks, they are seeing a little bit better yield potential than what they had originally anticipated. So hopefully we'll have a little bit more volume going into the end of the season, but it still is very much a short crop. But trying to stay more of an opportunistic opportunity and be optimistic, it is a little bit better than what was originally thought, but certainly well below, if not below half, then more than half of what a traditional crop would be throughout most of our growing region.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management was created when the King Ranch turned 150 years old back in 2003.
Dr. Clay Mathis is director of the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management.
And the family saw a challenge that the skill set it took to manage ranches in the future was going to be different than the skill set that was needed in the decades or century ahead. And so the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management was created to train master's students through a Master's of Science in Ranch Management program. And our graduate students have ranch management experience after a bachelor's degree.
On the topic of sustainability.
Sustainable ranching, it's kind of a topic that makes some of us excited and some of us a little bit uncomfortable. You know, when we think about sustainability and ranching sustainability, from our industry's perspective, we've always thought that way. Success in ranching was being able to pass the ranch on to the next generation, being a profitable business that could sustain those generations to come, and at the same time, improve the land, take good care of the livestock and the wildlife. And so that's who we've always been. But in the last decade or so, it seems like as an industry, we're faced with having to prove it just a little bit more to the rest of the world. And we created this symposium to certainly identify what are some of the challenges with to sustainability and what we face in ranching today. But what was really mostly behind what we were doing to create this symposium was finding those opportunities that this creates. We have an opportunity to tell the good works that we've done in this industry, and we need to be better at that. It's not who we are culturally to brag on ourselves, but there's things that we can do that can make us better. And so we've created this symposium to educate those that are interested in what's really the state of the discussion and sustainability from a ranching perspective. How do we measure that? And then how do we get better and market that sustainability as well?
Why should we focus on the definition?
The point that you're making is exactly why the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef was created, and even more so the United States Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. Those roundtables were created so that we would be at the table, so that we could work throughout the beef supply chain to identify what those metrics would be and how would we define the continuous improvement towards sustainability. So the three pillars are environmentally sound, socially acceptable, and economically viable. And all three of those are interrelated. You know, when we think about economically or in environmentally sound, we think about greenhouse gases. We think about water runoff and rangelands that are in good condition. We think about the efficiencies of a lot of the practices that we do and how they can contribute to improving our environment. And when we do that, we gain more social acceptance in those practices. And when we gain more social acceptance, that leads to more consumer trust, which affects price, whether it's for beef or lamb products from these ranches, or it's some of those recreational opportunities. But we have to have consumer trust in what we do so that we can generate the revenue to become economically viable or to improve economic viability. So those are all interrelated. We have to see those as one system, not just as independent pillars.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Climate Smart Ag and Forestry in itself is a mouthful.
John Duff is with the National Sorghum Producers.
And it is. It's $1 billion. It's a huge pot of money. It's a huge effort. Of course, the grant program that you're referring to, $1 billion, saw extremely strong interest. We applied along with 450 other, along with 349 other groups, for a total of 450 programs that were proposed under this. And in a nutshell, what USDA is trying to do is figure out how and help the market figure out how to function, the ecosystem services market, that is. There's a lot of opportunity, obviously, in sustainability and carbon and general ecosystem services for American agriculture. We are the leaders in agricultural sustainability, bar none. And we are largely not compensated for that, apart from the compensation that comes back from for the commodity production itself. And so everyone's trying to figure out how to monetize that, how to get farmers compensated for that. But a lot of people are calling it the Wild West right now in terms of what these markets are paying for, how they're paying, what frameworks they're using, what methodologies, the value practices, how they're compensating the farmer, what the contract looks like, what the terms look like. All those things are very, very up in the air and very unknown. And so what this program is trying to do is get to the bottom of all that, say, here's what the practices should be. Here's what the value should be. Here's how the market should function. Here's how the contract should look. Here's what the terms should be. And help farmers really get better opportunities that are safer, less risky, that compensate them better and more fairly for the value of the ecosystem services markets that they're providing. And we submitted a program and project, like I said, just like 349 of the groups did. And it's, you know, it offers a menu of practices, value on how an ecosystem services market in California values them. Farmers will have the opportunity to pick and implement those practices in order to receive compensation.
And he says sorghum is best suited to lead the effort.
We kicked off our application talking about sorghum's survival. Over 10,000 years of climate variability, which has led to us being able to trademark it as the resource-conserving crop. You can't get a trademark for just anything. You can't come up with something that isn't true or nobody's ever thought of and used in any form of communication before and trademark it. You can't do it. And we got a trademark in extremely short order for the resource-conserving crop because we've been using that language for many years, and the crop has survived through 10,000 years of climate variability. And so we've been at that table. We've been touting our sustainability attributes for many, many years now. And anybody familiar with the crop knows that it's a water-sipping crop. It waits for moisture. It tolerates the heat pretty well relative to other crops. It adds structure and organic matter back to the soil. It has a number of other attributes that consumers demand and desire these days, from no gluten to the fact that it's an ancient grain to many antioxidants, more than blueberries, and high protein, high fiber. It really checks a number of boxes in the area of sustainability, regardless of how you define that term. And we're really, really excited now to hopefully get it recognized as the resource-conserving crop that it really is.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We've had, you know, some really good preliminary conversations with Kenya previously, and it's hard to believe now that was almost 2 years ago.
Former Chief Ag Negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative Greg Dowd says Africa could be big for the U.S.
You've seen Kenya make some moves here with regard to biotechnology that are encouraging. I think there are countries, at least from my conversations, that are less and less interested in following the EU regulatory regime, particularly down the path of the Farm to Fork initiative. So I think we have to engage with African countries on the regulatory and the SBS side of the equation. And I think most of them are willing to have, they want to pursue that with the United States. I think we need to show more leadership in that regard. The potential for trade is there, but it's on down the road a ways. I mean, Kenya is only a $700 million market for U.S. ag exports, but the potential is there. If you can get the pilot program going in the base camp, you're going to have lots of potential going forward in future decades. With regard to India, it's a really great question. And the answer is in the year 2020, we spent at USTR about a year with India and the trade minister there trying to figure a way and a pass through for a very, very modest agreement, and we were unsuccessful, and it was frustrating. And the frustration in India with regard to reform of agricultural policy in any way, shape, or form is excruciatingly difficult. As you, most people don't know, they tried to reform their agricultural markets here two or three years ago. After two or three years of trying to implement a law that they had passed, they had to abandon the effort because of the resistance within different sections of the agricultural community. We were unsuccessful because of that same type of resistance. India has some of the highest tariffs, or they do have the highest tariffs of around 100% on agricultural products imported from anywhere in the world. They're very, very difficult. It's a market with enormous potential, not just for us, but for everywhere around the world. But as of right now, the ability to penetrate that is just not happening.
Moving from frustration with trade to ideas of year-round E15. Deb Fisher, Senator from Nebraska.
On E15 year-round, I think that's an important part of our energy policy here in the United States. It's certainly important to my state of Nebraska. And right now, we have a good working partnership with the American Petroleum Institute, who are supportive of E15 sales year-round. We are working on language, on legislation, to make sure that that we continue with that support. And we'll be ready to go, maybe to get something out here just at the end of the year to have it available so that individuals and groups can look it over as a piece of legislation. But when you have petroleum and corn come together, that is a huge accomplishment. It's a big step. And so I'm looking forward to working with these folks, because they also understand the importance of all of the above energy policy. You know, I support oil. I support coal. I support nuclear. I am a firm believer in all of the above. And we need to work together. We need to support the different segments of the energy industry, because we're seeing attacks from government, the current administration. And if we are going to truly survive as a strong energy industry in the United States, we better work together.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The hard to decarbonize areas, like airlines, like industrial, like trucking, require something different.
Jennifer Granholm is Secretary of Energy.
We're not going to probably in anytime soon be able to electrify, for example, airplanes. So we've got to have them run on sustainable fuels. And there's going to be a 40% increase in the demand for that fuel for airlines before 2050. So we've got to get cracking on making sure that they're running on fuels that are sustainable. And that means that having a sustainable aviation fuel supply is going to be massive. So the global airline industry this week announced a commitment to 100% sustainable aviation fuels by 2050. In the United States, we have done that as well. And that means for the U.S. fleet alone, it's going to be 35 billion gallons every year that is necessary to create that sustainable aviation fuel. We've also committed, we've had our own sustainable aviation fuel grand challenge, $3 billion gallons that we want to have annually by 2030, billion. So we're going to need a lot of new refineries to be able to meet that goal, about 200 new refineries, and we're going to be able to bolt on equipment to the existing refineries if they choose to do this, to be able to supply that fuel. We want to make sure that there's support for that in the reconciliation bill that's currently before Congress, and there is. So the pieces are all coming together to be able to include and have the ag community lead, the rural community of our country lead in producing the sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF as we call it.
And what about solar?
I'm here with Senator John Ossoff in Georgia, and he has been the leader in producing this bill called the Solar Energy Manufacturing Act. And what we want to do is incentivize the manufacturing and the deployment of solar across our country to help our energy mix be clean. In the same way, of course, that we've seen wind be really taken up very robustly by the ag community, we want to have solar be a part of that mix as well. So we want to be able to not just install panels that are manufactured elsewhere, like in China. We want to make them here. We want to make the racks here. We want to make sure that we incentivize and pay for the production here so that our ag community and the rest of the country can also benefit from that. We're announcing today a big community solar goal, which is that we want to power another 5 million homes with community solar by 2025. So lots of big goals, and now we've only got to move toward them.
At the end of the day, this idea of sustainable fuels could be big for ag.
We were just at this LanzaTech this morning, which is a company that does the sustainable aviation fuels. And the technology that they're using is so interesting. They take ethanol and they need other pollutants. They take waste and they put it into a process that's a biological process, and out comes fuel that is sustainable. So the notion of what's going on technology-wise and how biologic processes are being used to convert waste into fuel is really exciting. You can do it with the municipal solid waste. You can do it certainly with the waste from forests and trees, and you can do it with the offtake from carbon out of just regular ethanol production. So it's, to me, that kind of waste to energy and waste to sustainable energy is very exciting, and that's part of my crystal ball.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One of the reasons we're talking about this is inflation's a key to both farmland, but also farmland, because farmland is a hedge against inflation, but also interest rates, obviously.
Looking at interest rates earlier this year, Dr. Michael Engemeyer with Purdue Center for Commercial Ag.
Let's review where interest rates have been recently. Federal funds rate was only 0.33%. The 10-year Treasury was 2.75%. The 10-year Treasury is more something that we compare to real estate rates, whereas the Fed fund rate and the prime rate is more to operating loan rate. The prime rate was 3.5%. In early May, the Federal Reserve increased the Fed fund rate about 0.5% or half a percent. That gets us up to about 0.9% for the Fed fund rate. The 10-year Treasury increased to over 3% in early May, and the prime rate went up to 4%. Based on what the news from the Federal Reserve Board, they're expecting the prime rate or the Fed rate, Fed funds rate, to increase another percentage. That would add a percent to the prime rate, moving that towards 5% if that does happen. The question that Jim asked me this morning, we actually added this to the slide: what does this mean for farm operating interest rates? Well, there's not a direct link between the prime rate and the operating interest rates, but they do tend to move together. And so if we saw a 1.5% increase in the operating interest rate from April, for example, we would be looking at operating interest rates from 6 to 6.5%. That sounds really high, but that's about where we were pre-COVID. If you look at 2018, 2019, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the interest rates were right around 5.756%. So we're going back to where we were pre-COVID. Again, the Federal Reserve Board does not look at forecasting the prime rate. Rather, they look at the Fed funds rate. And so we can imply what the increases in Fed funds rate, what that might be doing to other interest rates, because this is a fundamental interest rate that people look at from a forecast standpoint. They're expecting that funds rate to go up to 1.9%. That'd be the 1.5% increase in 22. That's where I'm getting the 6 to 6.5% operating interest rate. And then they're expecting another percentage increase as we move into 23. Longer run, they're expecting that Fed funds rate to be 2.4%. And so if this all materializes, that means operating interest rate is not heading to 4% anytime soon. We're looking more at like 6%, 6.5% long run.
Now, again, we bring this up to compare to the 80s, but Lengemeyer says this isn't a repeat of the 80s.
I just remember from the early 80s how hard it was to reduce inflation. Obviously, we were dealing with higher inflation than we're talking about today, but nevertheless, it's difficult. And so this may, all I'm saying is it may take a little longer than what the Fed was forecasting to tame inflation. And so, obviously, a lot of uncertainty. I wanted to throw in a chart there, from a historical standpoint, what this increase in Fed rate means. 1.9% in 22, 2.8% in 23. Obviously, that's much different environment than what we've seen since the spring of 2020, right after COVID hit. They reduced that Fed funds rate to almost zero. Now we're moving into that environment where we're closer to 18, 19, but we're not going back to where we were in 2000. 2007, for example. We had the major crisis in the U.S. economy in 2008. We're not going back to that 5%. We're going back to that environment that we had in 2018, 2019.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A mostly bearish to flat round of crop reports Friday from USDA. The only new row crop production forecast of any consequence was for cotton. That new cotton forecast showing a larger crop than industry analysts had expected at 14.2 million bales, 2% more than was being forecast a month ago, still 19% below last year's crop. The increase in production coming from a 13-pound an acre boost in average yields now estimated at 868 pounds an acre. That's up 49 pounds from last year's crop. Despite a bigger than expected crop, though, no change to USDA's average price forecast. That still stands at 85 cents a pound. That would be about 6.5 cents below last season's average. USDA analysts did note for some crops a fairly sluggish fall export pace, so they took a dime off their average price forecasts for corn and wheat, 90 cents a hundredweight off the expected all rice price. Nonetheless, besides cotton, the price prospects in the marketing year for most crops higher than last season. Gary Crawford, Washington.